Hello there, I'm Chris Difford and welcome to the podcast I never thought it would happen, made in collaboration with the wonderful charity Help Musicians. In this episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by a singer who was inspired by Joe Strummer and Susie Sue, Prince, Blondie and Marvin Gaye. She's quite incredible, really. I love a lady that plays guitar. And they had a single back in the day called I Don't Want to Love Her. And I remember listening to it on the radio thinking, these guys have got it. She's got an amazing band who have fantastic success. I saw them at Glastonbury last year. Please let me introduce you to Charlene Spiteri. Welcome to this Help Musicians podcast. So lovely to see you. Your face makes me smile. It's just lovely to see you.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, it was really funny because my mate, one of my girlfriends, just left the house there. And I said, oh, you'll never guess who I'm doing a podcast with. And she went, oh, no way. She went, oh, my God, I loved Squeeze. I went, so did I. I went, I loved Squeeze so much. And then we literally went through all the lyrics of Up the Junction. I was like, I says, do you know when I remember when I first heard that? And I says, I think it was the first time I felt really sad. Like,
yeah,
it was like a warning of, oh my God, be really careful what you do in life because that's what could happen. And because it was just so, it was such a clear story.
Yeah.
Then a song. And it was like a life lesson. It was just unbelievable.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, where were you when you first heard that then?
I was in Glasgow. I was, you know, I was a geeky little teenager, just obsessed with music and being like in bands and watching Top of the Pops and dancing with my sister and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. When you're in Glasgow in those days, was there bands that you would go and see?
At that point, I was still a wee bit too young. But yeah, I was never really, it's weird because I was always into bands. I remember my first gig was Simple Minds at Tiffany's.
Okay.
And it was during the sort of the love song period where I used to just love that. And it's funny because I did a thing for Jim and Charlie a couple of months ago. They were doing a whole documentary on Simple Minds.
Yeah.
I said, I was 14 at the time. I says, and my big cousin took me because Tiffany's was a nightclub and I was underage and I was trying to look older and going there. But I remember being like blown away because I was thinking, wow, that's really strange. That looks like a woman's blouse he has on. And it was funny because Jim says, mate, it was my mom's blouse. He says, I literally stole out my mother's wardrobe and I was literally like, he just told me that reason. I was like, oh my God, it wasn't your mother's blouse. So yeah, it was in his mom's blouse.
That's brilliant. When I saw you at Glastonbury last year, I guess it was now, the thing that came across so much was your enthusiasm and your commitment to being on stage. It was just so wonderful to watch and to observe. It made me feel very privileged to see your show. Is that something that you feel you've developed over the years, or have you always felt like that?
In the beginning, I was just like kind of like almost like not like a deer in the headlights. At the beginning, there was just so much to take in, and it was like, you know, I mean, I remember hanging on at my guitar like so tightly, like grim death, because it was kind of like my protection between me and the audience. You know, like the first gig we played was Dundee University in the bar. I mean, literally, it was about 4 inches high, the stage, and I was still shorter than most of the audience. And I remember being like, it was 1988, and I was like hanging on because it was just before we released I Don't Want to Love Her and the January 89. I remember hanging on to the guitar and thinking, oh my God, would I say, I was fine when I was singing, but would I say, and how to act, or would I do? And it was that sort of thing where, yeah, but then comes the, after you've done it for a certain length of time, which you know yourself, is suddenly you realise that I am really privileged. I mean, anybody that does something that they love, as they always say, is privileged. You know, be doing something that you love, that you make a living from. But the longer and longer that it does go on, Yeah, I do. I do feel very, very privileged to stand on that stage and to sing the songs, and I feel privileged to still be relevant.
Right, yeah, that's nice.
It's like I do. I really do. You know, as a woman in music, to have done it for such a long time,
Yeah.
I do feel very privileged.
Well, it actually shows, and that's a very spiritual place to be on that stage.
It really is. I mean, you know, somebody said to me, "What is it like?" And I went, it's literally like, says, you know, when you stick your head out a car that's driving like 100 miles an hour, and it's like, that's kind of what it feels like. It's like, you know, it's really exciting and it's like thrilling and it's like, you know, as you get older as well, there's those great moments now where you can really stand back because you're not scared of space. You're not scared of the pause. You know, as when you're young, you're just trying to fill everything. Then you're like, ooh, you know, you think anything when there's nothing happening is dead space.
Yeah.
Now I can literally just stand back and go, you know, I love that, being able to just stand back and soak it up. And yeah, I mean, I have to say that when we did Glastonbury, I mean, there were quite a few moments where I really did have to just stand back for a minute and kind of like, because I was trying to get my act together, because I was literally like, oh, because I was so taken aback by the amount of love that was coming off that audience. Because I had that thing where I thought, okay, we're playing on the Friday, it's quite a blokey day, we're in with, you know, the Foo Fighters and Royal Blood and the Arctic Monkeys, and I thought it's going to be quite indie and it's going to be, you know, like, how are we going to fit in? Not fit in, but how is that going to go down? And I thought most of the people that are standing in the audience don't even know they know a Texas song, but I know they do know a Texas song, and that was the thing. I was like, I know they know quite a few Texas songs, they just don't know they know it.
Yeah.
So I had that in my head. So
That's
I thought, okay,
great.
if I can get them, you know, if I can just be like, right, come on, come with me. But I didn't think they were going to act the way they acted, where they were just like sang from the
Yeah.
beginning, sang so much and were just so happy. And I was like, oh my God, this is insane. This is like the best day of my life. I just loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved it. You know, people always say Glastonbury's really special. And, you know, I feel even more special that I've had the opportunity within my life to play it twice. So
Yeah.
I'm playing the Pyramid Stage twice. In
Yeah.
fact, I've actually done it three, because then I went and did another set as
Oh,
well.
did you?
But yeah, it's yeah, I mean, I feel very lucky. And as I said, it felt like a very special day that will definitely stay with me. And, you know, it's changed something since that performance at Glastonbury. There's definitely been a big change. You know, suddenly like Fred again was like playing Inner Smile and as he closed his Ali Pali show and everything. And I was like, my daughter was literally like, Mum, check this out. You're actually quite cool. It's only taking 21 years to hear those words come out our mouth. You know, yeah, that's a you problem. It was good.
Absolutely. When you were a teenager, what kind of attracted you to the guitar? Because it's not many women that pick up a guitar like you have.
My dad played guitar, completely self-taught. My dad was a merchant seaman. Both my parents were really into music. My mum's family were all, my granda played unbelievable boogie-woogie piano.
Really?
Jules and I have had many conversations about this. But yeah, and it was really funny because my granda had a finger that had, in an accident, had got sawn off.
Wow.
Sawn three fingers off his hand, right? And basically went to the hospital with them in a hanky and had them all sewn back on. But the pinky finger, the nerves never knitted together. And my granda used to have this pinky finger that literally looked like a little pencil.
Yeah.
It was really thin and really shiny.
Yeah.
And he used to say to us, I'll give you £1 if you can bend my finger. And we'd all be hanging granda's finger. But when he played boogie-woogie piano, this pinky was like, and he'd be like,
Yeah.
you know, when he was doing his, and this hand, you know, well, it was like going, and this pinky was always there. My Uncle Bobby played phenomenal boogie-woogie because he was taught at such a young age from a granda. My mum, they could all sing. My mum was amazing jazz singer, and Mark Marling was phenomenal. And my cousin, Mark Rankin, who was in the band Gunn.
Yeah.
So that's my mum's sister's son. And literally, we grew up together. My cousin Mark, my sister, and I grew up like brothers and sisters after school every day at my gran's. And there was a Hammond organ in the front hall. There was a upright piano in the big room, and they had like in this big room, it was a bit like a scene for like the original Ocean's 11, because my granddad was a stonemason and he built this amazing kind of like sort of amazing fireplace that had seated bits in it and everything, and the piano fitted in exactly at the end. Then there was a bar at the end that had like, you know, like glasses and
Yeah,
light.
always a bar, yeah.
Yeah, there was a bar in there, and that was like the party room. And my grandparents used to have like a big get together once a month, and loads of people came in, some other musicians and stuff. And yeah, my granddad played accordion and everything, and it was like off it would go, and you had to do a turn. And you know, whether that was you sang a song or you performed something, but you had to do something. So, you know, me and all my cousins like literally grew up in Glasgow and amongst that and that music, and we all played a bit of piano, a bit of guitar. You know, there was always instruments a bit, is that you kind of just mess about on it and learn as you went
What
along.
was your dad's influence?
My dad was very into like the Byrds and Gene
Oh,
Clarke,
really?
and
Wow.
yeah, he was really into that and the Stones and a lot of the California stuff, because my dad worked big oil company called Denham's and worked in America. So like he was in San Francisco most of the early 60s and 70s. So he was very into that whole psychedelic thing and everything, and came back, you know, with all those records. But that was that. And then my mum was the other side. My mum was very like Mahalia Jackson, Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, all that kind of stuff. A lot of big band stuff as well. And that's where the sort of soul and blues came from. A lot of gospel, a lot of that kind of music was what I grew up with. And then my sort of youth was You Guys and Dexys and Echo and the Bunnymen, Susie and the Banshees and
The Pretenders are a bit,
Enders, everything, Blondie. That was my time. But yeah, you know, I loved the Pretenders, and I loved Chrissie's stance and her attitude, and that she had this funny voice. It's such a beautiful voice. Chrissie Hynde's voice is one of the most beautiful voices, soul voices you'll ever hear. And
It really is.
I just loved that she had this voice and this attitude and this guitar.
I remember talking to Chris Thomas about her, and he said that her voice was the main instrument in that band. You know,
Yeah.
and that he had to have it right in the front of the mix was the most important thing. And thank God that he did.
Have you ever heard Chrissie's demo version of Stop Your Sobbing?
No, I don't think I have.
Oh, you got to hear the demo version of, because it's pretty different to the record. And it is just, yeah, it's, you know, it's all voice, and you're just like, whoa.
How do you get on with touring? Do you enjoy it? Is it something that you sort of love?
I love being on stage. When I'm on stage, I don't care. I don't care about all the traveling. And, you know, I used to when I was like, for years and years and years. I'd probably say only after COVID, touring's been like, you know, between touring and Brexit, seriously, traveling is literally such a schlep, really hard. It's really getting dragged off buses with passport control and this and checks and everything. And oh my God, it's just too much. Before, it was just really easy to just get on a bus and go around Europe. But literally everything, all the checks now of looking for visas and passports and this and that, is it makes it, you know, long, laborious. And, you know, it's made traveling a lot harder. It's fine. I mean, you forget about it. When you go on that stage, you forget about everything. I just had shoulder surgery just before Christmas, and they'd said that I wouldn't play guitar. And I was like, oh my God. I mean, I don't play guitar on every song on stage, but I do play guitar, and there's songs that I've never not played guitar and sang them. And I was like, oh God, oh my God. You know that thing? I was like, oh God, what am I going to do? I was like, but I ended up, so I saw the surgeon just before I went, and I was a bit like, you know, do you think I can play guitar? And he says, you can give it a shot. He really made me laugh because he said to me, you'll be fine with like a telly. And I was like, listen to you.
Listen to him.
And he says, I'll play a little bit of guitar. I went, of course you do. I don't really think I've met a surgeon that does not
A
play.
guitar, yeah.
You know, so yeah, he says, you'll be fine with like a telly or something.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so that really did make me chuckle. But I played my Gretsch, so.
Oddly, a Telecaster can normally be heavier than a Gretsch, so.
Well, exactly. It was the thing that was difficult was it was just about my arm going over. Like
Ah, I see.
I still can't play an acoustic.
Really?
Forget it. I can't get my arm over. I can
A
do that.
strum, yeah.
I just can't do the rotation.
Yeah.
But because my G Gretsch is like it's not as thick, but it's also I'm playing a lot lower. My
Yeah.
hand is in the right position that I can play.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
I think no chance.
Yeah.
I'm Andrew Brown, and I'm proud to be one of the thousands of artists supported by Help Musicians. I'm a bass player based in Cardiff, and I've been playing professionally for about 15 years now. I play bass in a Cardiff-based band, Afrocluster, and a few other sort of projects, wedding and function bands, and currently working in a Joni Mitchell tribute show as well. Afrocluster was formed in 2009. I was a founding member along with the lead vocalist MC, Toomey Williams, MC Skunkadelic, wanting to marry our two loves of Fela Kuti sort of style Afrobeat and hip hop and Afrofunk. And during lockdown 2020, we released our full length debut album after releasing loads of EPs. I would say the first band I ever properly fell for were The Who. Seeing John Entwistle play bass on TV for the first time made me think, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. The way he stood there, really stoic. He stood very still, but his fingers moved like lightning. And it was such an unconventional sort of style of bass for the time. He was given the space by Townsend to explore and revolutionise rock bass playing. And the second moment was in high school. I went to a fairly working class high school that couldn't afford instruments. But there was a local charity that are still going today called Community Music Wales. And they would come in every week after school hours and bring instruments and form like sort of a band club thing. And then I walked in and got a bass shoved on my lap, and that was it, really. That was the two defining moments, I think, that made me think, yeah, this is what I want to do. Afrocluster is, we're a 9-piece band, so logistically it's always hard to organise. And we'd released EP after EP, and we thought, right, now we really want to get this debut album sorted. And yeah, we eventually got it all ready to release, and then unfortunately the pandemic happened, so we held it back a bit, but then we realized it's going to last longer than we thought, so let's just get it out there. Another bucket list thing for us to do was that we released it on vinyl as well, because we're like, a lot of our music is hip-hop orientated, so having it on vinyl was a big bucket list thing for us to do. Most musicians, when they get into music, they don't think about the marketing side, they just want to make music. But if you've got a record and you've got no know-how to market it, then it's not going to go anywhere, really. So Help Musicians gave us funding specifically for that, so we were able to spend that money on a radio plugger to market and service the album. A part of that sort of support, we had a sort of group Zoom meeting with an industry professional that could talk us through the sort of ins and outs of how marketing works and how to fully properly promote a record. It doesn't happen in a vacuum. You have to put in those kind of like behind the scenes kind of work to create momentum and timing, which is, I think, is two most important things. Getting the momentum and timing right and marketing and all that kind of stuff is essential, really. You're constantly chasing and trying to keep up with social media trends. I think artist development has changed a hell of a lot now, because record companies are expecting you to be the full package. You've got to do your own marketing, you've got to do your own booking, your own servicing of singles, and especially if you're an indie artist, you can't afford the whole team, you know? Apart from the funding I had with Afrocluster, Help Musicians UK helped me out personally in a big way over the last couple of years, because I had a few health issues going on and they helped me out incredibly. This is the element I wasn't aware of. I thought it was just industry stuff they could help me with. But I've got a degenerative eye condition. My eyesight isn't great, and I have to have these highly specialized contact lenses. And I had a cornea transplant a couple of years ago. And on the whole, my sight is okay if I've got the right lenses, but I had a really bad period of ill health with my eyes where the NHS couldn't find me a proper contact lens. So I was left. I had to go through a summer's worth of festivals and touring, partially sighted and a lot of pain with ulcers in my eyes and no help really. So I had to make the decision to stop playing because my health was getting worse and worse. And that's where I applied for Help Musicians funding to help with loss of work through taking some time out. And incredibly, they funded me to go private to get the contact lenses. So I went to a clinic in London. They covered my clinic fees as well. Obviously, there's a lot of mental health issues surrounding it as well, uncertainty of work and whether I can keep doing this. And Help Musicians UK really did save me in a lot of ways, both physically and mentally. So I'm forever thankful for that. I should have been resting, really, trying to recover, but obviously you worry about the next sort of run of money that's going to come through, so it kind of just, yeah. But luckily, yeah, Help Musicians UK were there, and I had a good support network of colleagues as well that helped me through it. The hardest part is the travelling and the touring and not being able to sort of eat the best food you can, you know. And yeah, with the long journeys, I try to take my own food when I can and not totally rely on the M4 services, which I've become very accustomed to over the years. But yeah, it doesn't always go to plan. Yeah, I do read a lot, so I've always got a book. I do journal a lot as well, so I try to make a sort of record of where I've been, how the gig was. Especially in the Afro Cluster van, we rotate sort of music, different playlists. We create our own playlists for a specific journey. Everyone contributes. On the way home, we usually have like, I don't know, it sounds a bit lame, but we'll have like quizzes and stuff. Crosswords are a big part of the van life as well. Doesn't sound so rock and roll. I had to put more importance on my rest days. So if I've come off tour, then it's going to take me a couple of days to recover. And I've got to be okay with that rather than be up at Monday morning feeling like I should be doing something. So having that sort of discipline to say, right, this is your rest day. The funding is there, it's set aside and it's waiting there for you. All you need to do is just be a little bit diligent. And if you go on the Help Musicians UK website, they've got all the instructions on how to apply, what to apply for and how to do it laid out very clearly. And yeah, if you don't get it the first time, then that is not like, no, you're never going to get funding ever again. Keep at it, keep refining your applications. Because it's not going to come to you in this industry, you've got to keep pushing and pushing and get what you can. And yeah, so I'd highly recommend Help Musicians UK.
Help Musicians is a charity for working musicians across the UK. To find out more about the support they offer, why they do what they do, and how to support them in creating a world where musicians can thrive, visit helpmusicians.org.uk or find them on social media today.
Help Musicians has a fantastic helpline for people that are struggling, and you know, you do a lot of well-being kind of stuff around music. Do you have that kind of support around the band when you're on the road?
Like, as in, like, physios or anything?
No, I mean, do you say, okay, you guys, tonight, you know, we just got to take it easy, not drink too much, you know, all that sort of stuff?
To be really honest, I mean, as a band, you know, we've had a run-in with, not me personally, but members of the band have had their run-ins with drugs and alcohol, and we've had those moments on stage where suddenly somebody falls off a stage or disappears or something, you know. But we have had those moments. Jesus, would you be a band if you hadn't had those moments?
Sure, exactly, yeah.
As long as I keep singing, nobody really cares. I always say to my band, I went, the only person that can't fall off the stage or disappear is me. You're all replaceable, remember that.
You're the boss.
I'm like, let's get real, boys. This is how it works. But no, it's you know, the great thing that I love about my band is that we know what being in Texas has given us. We know the lifestyle that it's allowed us to have. We know that it's allowed us that freedom of sleepless nights that you can go to bed thinking, okay, life's all right. We're in a good place. It's like, it's fine.
Yeah.
We've been very naturally easy at staying in our lanes, you know?
Okay. That's really good. I love that description.
I'll be honest. I think having a woman in the band
Yeah.
Really helps that.
Yeah.
Even if I'm wrong, which I'm really never, but, you know, even if I know I'm right and somebody's like saying, and I know they're wrong, I'll go, oh yeah, okay, you're right. Just to move on or to whatever, you know? And I think having that, you know, as a woman, I can be like, oh, stop being a dick.
Yeah. God, I wish we had a woman in the band now. You've told me that.
But I can say stop being a dick without it being like, well, I got to stand my ground here between two guys. I can be stopped. Or if two are going off, I'll be like, you've been a dick.
Yeah.
A dick as well. Stop being two dicks. When it comes to me, it's a bit like, then I can literally lay it and take the absolute piss.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it like suddenly... it kind of like, it just makes everything sort of like fade and...
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then it's easy. So I think kind of having a woman in the band is really, really helpful.
I think so. Yeah.
And maybe really given us that when maybe things could have gone off the rails of, you know, when everybody's like, I'm going to stand my ground. You know, the only two people that ever go at it is me and Johnny.
Yeah.
Johnny and I go at it sometimes where when we're in the studio and I'll be like, no. And he'll be like, well, why are you just singing the same way that you always sing? And I'm like, fuck you. And then he'll really piss me off. And then I'll be like, then you kind of, there's that little seed in your head where it's like, am I just singing the way I always sing? He's like, oh, you always do that little inflection that you do. And I'm like, then you're like, yeah, you know, you put that brave face on, you're a bit like that, but in your mind is going, is that the thing that I always do?
Yeah.
Have I just fallen into like a goo that it's just repetitive? So then what it does is it pushes me and I'll do it to, you know, we all do it to each other. I'll be like, oh, that again?
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of good. It kind of makes you shake a tail feather and go into peacock mode. It's like...
it's good to listen to other people, even if you think they're wrong, I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think it really is. And
it's taken me years to do that. I used to just sulk.
Oh, I still sulk.
Oh, you do?
You know what? To be honest, I don't sulk. I basically go mental and then just go, okay, right, I got that out of my system, thanks very much, and then move on, whereas guys sulk. They like sulk and I'm going, oh, you're in a bad mood. You know, I can get away with that kind of shit, but you, another guy doing that to you is that's an absolute no-no.
So is everybody healthy in the band?
Everybody's really healthy in a good place now. You know, they're very conscious, like, of there's a job to do and we're not as young as we used to be and the heavy drinking or whatever would happen in the past
subsides.
They know they can't get up the next day and do it, but days off, there's still some nights where you end up in hotels. If there's a piano in a lobby,
That's it.
That's a big problem.
Isn't it?
Walk in the hotel and you see a piano in a lobby, you go, and you know there's a day off, you're like, oh shit,
here we go,
you know, here we go, this is going to be a session. That's what happens. But the laughs you have and the people you meet and the things that have happened around the piano.
Amazing.
And the work that we've had done on our houses via people that we've met in those hotels round that piano. That's like, I'm a glass specialist and I'm a this specialist. I'm a steels guy. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, I need some steels for my house. Doing an extension. You know, it's like that kind of thing.
When you're writing, are you a good co-writer?
Oh, I don't know. God, I don't know.
Is that something you sort of enjoy or not?
I like to do certain things. There's never a pattern to it. The only absolute definite about whenever we do another record, whenever we make a new album, is that someone needs to have given me a notebook. I mean, I got a pile of notebooks that people have given me in the past. And I keep them and then I write on the side, you know, Texas number, whatever it is. And that's the only thing that is a certainty when we've gone into that next record. But I don't really want to know how we do it.
No.
Does that sound really stupid?
No, not at all. You've got a process that you've built up as a band over the years. It's natural for you to write like that.
Then I just sound like a record company executive. Well, this is how we do it. It's like,
yeah.
Whatever's going on in your life, I mean, there's been so many records that I've been in so many different places whenever we've been working on them. The only one that was really, really weird was when I did the solo album, and that was literally done out of slight embarrassment within the band, because I had split from the father of my daughter at that point, and there was a lot of pain, there was a lot of stuff, and you know, my band were like, you know, and I didn't want to argue over a guitar solo or how the pattern was or where this was, and it was a very feminine record.
It was like therapy for you.
The band were involved with making that record. They were completely involved with making that record. You know, it was done with them by my side, but not in a sense that we sat and made a Texas record. It wasn't a Texas record. We knew it wasn't going to be we just knew it wasn't a Texas record. As soon as we started doing it, like, this is not a Texas record. This is this. And it was almost like, okay, do this. Great. Oh, okay, now I'm ready to make a Texas record. And it was almost like having to get something out of my system.
So were you writing it to the other person?
No, I think it was writing it to myself.
Okay, as a reflection.
Yeah, as a reflection, as, you know, I never even knew I was writing it to myself when I was writing it. So I didn't question it. It was just like, you know, now I see it as that.
Yeah.
And I guess it was reassuring myself as well. There was a lot of reassurance within it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you are worth it. Yeah, that wasn't nice. That shouldn't have happened. That person shouldn't have done that. You know, there was a lot of that within it.
As a lyricist, I find it difficult sometimes to share my feelings about my relationships with other songwriters unless they're going to be open enough to accept what's going on with me. So if, you know, in Squeeze, for instance, sometimes it's difficult to be that honest with one's feelings. You have to take them outside of the pitch.
Again, I do think it's harder for men to show that side because you're inherently brought up to almost see that as a weakness. So I can understand that sharing that with someone else and so getting someone else's take on it is like intrusion of your privacy to a certain degree. Whereas, you know, I am very of the school of, you know, I always think like what that lyric means to me, I don't want it to mean the same to you. And I don't want it to mean the same to you. I want everybody, it's something different, because instantly, you know, whenever I listen to someone else's songs and someone else's lyrics, I put the faces that I know and the situations that I know into that place. And then that's why I love the song, because then I connected with an emotion and a feeling in it. Whether that is the songwriter is not even at that point important to me. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't want to think about you because it's not about you.
Yeah, yeah.
The song's then mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that is why music and songs are the truest, the art form that crosses generations, that crosses language, that crosses class, that, you know, it crosses everything, because it's not a flat interpretation.
Yeah.
It's visual, sonic, you know, when everything that you hear is like, makes the blood, it's like the speed your heart's pumping at, like how the blood going through your body. It's all those emotions and all those feelings
yeah,
that are literally merged together, and you're painting this picture in your head when you hear the lyrics, and you're seeing things, and it reminds you of things, and it reminds you of a time in your life or a place. And I think that's what's so wonderful. You know, I know that when we're touring all over the world, and we go into countries, and you know, you meet people and they don't speak a word English, but they just get the song. They just get it.
Yeah.
They're just like, I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I get it.
It's a different language. Yeah.
They're hearing what they're seeing, do you know what I mean? Rather than exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course.
Great, because the truth is even if you speak the language, you're not seeing exactly what I'm saying anyway. You don't know me. You don't know my situation, you know.
No. What do you think the relevance of the music industry is now compared to when you first had a band and you wanted to sign a record deal? Do you still feel like you have a good relationship with the music industry?
I've never had a great, to be brutally honest, I've never had a great relationship. From the day I got signed and the MD of my record company at Mercury Records, at that point I was sitting outside the office and the door was like ajar. And my managers were sitting in there and we were getting the deal. And I remember he referred to me as the dodgy boiler.
What?
Yeah, yeah. He went, so what's this dodgy boiler all about?
Jeez.
And I remember, and I was, you know, I was 18 years old and I was like, you motherfucker. I actually just remember thinking, that was my entrance into the music industry.
That says it all.
And that kind of like, you know, that was it. That put me... It actually worked really well for me.
Yeah.
Because it gave me the balls and the guts to go, no.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought I don't need to be. I'm always nice and I'm always like, well, I'm not always nice. That's a lie. I always like to think I'm quite fair and my mum would kill me if I wasn't well-mannered. So I'll say things and I'll say them very definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the kind of person that'll go, that's a no. And then somebody will say it to me in a slightly different way. And I went, you know, I'm a bit like, doesn't matter how many ways you ask me, the answer is going to remain the exact same.
Yeah.
Not change my mind on this. I don't feel that I need to please anybody, you know.
No, that's good. That's a very good attitude to have in the industry, I think.
And that was from the beginning. And I do think that that kind of put me in good stead to just be like, well, no, I won't be what you want me to be. Because I remember they were like, you dress like a boy and?
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, constantly for years it was like, oh, she must be a lesbian.
Oh, God.
Why? Well, you get short hair and you wear big boots.
Oh, God's sake.
You know that thing where you're just like going, really?
Mm.
Imagine saying that in this day and age. Well, I mean, the thing is what's really worrying is they still do say that shit. It's just that it's hidden really well.
Yeah, it's camouflaged.
And it's completely camouflaged. And everybody's like, oh, it's a lot better now. It's like, no, it's not. It's a lot worse because sometimes it's not right in front of your face.
Sure.
It's hidden so well that where do I stand here? So, yeah, I'd say, I've never been a fan and I've never had a great relationship with it. I've had great relationships with people that have worked on Texas and within the teams of Texas.
Sure.
That work at record companies.
Yeah.
Literally from, you know, Jeff Young, who signed us, with Nick Angel back then, always had a great relationship with them. And then our A&R man, Alan Pell, that was the guy that made, you know.
Oh, God, I know Alan. Yeah, he's lovely.
I love Alan Pell. I literally spoke to him the other day.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I phoned him up about something really. I know what I phoned him up for. I phoned him up to ask him if he had White on Blonde on vinyl, if he had a copy of it, because I was looking for something and I was like, I ended up finding a copy of it, but it was like, that was what I was looking for. And I phoned Alan. I was like, Alan, do you have a White on Blonde? He was like, no, I don't. I've got acetates, I've got this, I've got the tape, you know, just looking for something. He was amazing. I loved Alan, you know, Nicola, Marsha Hunt, all the people that worked with us. Great. I have a great relationship with my record company now with Pias, you know, and, you know, Russell, who literally was the person that came up with Spooner Oldham.
Mm.
He was the one that suggested Spooner because he knew Spooner's daughter.
Right.
When we were doing this piano record, he was like, what about Spooner Oldham? And we went, Spooner Oldham, is he still? And they were like, yeah, he's still, you know, he's still kicking about. He's 79, but he's still kicking about. And we recorded that record 2 years ago.
Fantastic, yeah.
But, you know, it was just brilliant. And the thing is that, you know, as a songwriter and a musician, you'll understand this. When we went to make the record with Spooner at Muscle Shoals at the Fame Studios, so basically this piano record is just the vocal and piano. That's the rule of it. And it's who owns PS Records. It's his like baby. He has, it's an artist. each year and they do this piano record. Some people do it with classical pianists, some do jazz, whatever. There was discussions of who we would do it with. And we kept going, because always whenever we do something, there has to be, you know, like there has to be a connection that is within the history of the band. Or, and basically it was Spooner did Keep On Talking, the Northern Soul classic. That seems like the right fit. So you do all your hit records with the piano. So all the tracks get sent over to Spooner, all the originals. We're like, here's the songs, have a listen, da da da. We come and record them all. And we're like, da da, going through. I've got all the list of the songs. We get to Inner Smile. Spooner goes, no. Johnny and I look at each other. We're like, well, and he, Spooner went, I don't do that Louie Louie shit.
Oh, wow.
And you know what? I was so flattered because I was literally, oh my God, he's playing all the other songs because he genuinely likes them. He's like, that's not my bag. I don't do that Louie Louie. That's not my thing.
How amazing. So honest.
So honest. And Inner Smile's not on the record because of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of the biggest songs. And we're like,
okay, fair enough.
Spooner doesn't want to do it. We ain't doing it.
Brilliant. You've got some massive shows coming up. That's going to be great fun, isn't it?
Well, again, you know, due to like the festivals last year and especially Glastonbury, we're now doing an arena tour and it's in September, which I'm, you know, I'm really excited about.
I am too. It looks amazing.
It's going to be fun. It's going to be really good fun.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat today, because Help Musicians will adore you for this, and I adore you for this too.
Oh, no, are you joking? I've got to say one thing to you.
Go on, then.
In 1989, I was going into a radio station, and you were coming out the radio station, coming the same. There was two of you, and literally you turned and you said to Ali and I were sitting waiting to go in. I don't know if it was Capital.
All right. Yeah.
It was one of those ones back in the day. And you turned and you went, it's nice to see someone writing Meat and Potatoes and Music again. I never, ever forgot it. Oh. And I was like, there you go.
God bless you. So lovely to see you. I'm almost in tears with that story. Thank you so much.
We were just starting out. It was our first record. We just released I Don't Want a Lover. And, you know, you guys were big pop stars. We were like, and, you know, major songwriters. It was literally like, you know, a major songwriter turning to you as a young artist and saying, you're all right, you. It really meant a lot. It really did mean a lot.
Oh, thank you. How is Ali, by the way? Good?
He's good. He's doing his thing with his wife, and they're doing their music. And Red Sky July, they're doing their whole thing. And yeah, he's sadly, he just lost his dad. And
I heard that yesterday. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, lovely to see you guys. I'm off to Paris now.
Okay, well, look, take great care, and hopefully we'll see you soon. I'd love to see you.
Definitely.
God bless you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, bye. Well, that was great fun. I know we've crossed paths once before, but we never had a conversation like we just had. She's an incredibly gifted person. As I said, you know, seeing her at Glastonbury brought tears to my eyes. So I hope you enjoyed that chat just as much as I did. You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.